It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's a poor man's guide to eating well in a very pricey place, San Francisco. Our guest is a local restaurant critic who claims to have been born with a plastic spoon in his mouth, Dan Leone. His Cheap Eats column is all about eating for 10 bucks or less. Our road food duo, Jane and Michael Stern, are presenting their doctoral dissertation on the onion ring. Equipment maven Dory Greenspan has had a religious conversion of sorts to juicers. Reporter Scott Haas is back from Food Lover's Paradise, the slow food meeting in Italy. And we get training tips from a new kind of athlete, a professional competitive eater. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. I was roaming the supermarket last night, and I started thinking about how many bottled dressings there are and how a lot of them don't deliver an awful lot of good taste. So I thought maybe a single, simple, homemade dressing concept might be helpful. The idea is you improvise one basic dressing that you can mix up just by shaking the ingredients together in a jar. And it keeps in the refrigerator for a week or more. Now, this dressing will be excellent on its own, but each time you use it, you could add different ingredients and make an entirely different recipe, from Italian to ranch to blue cheese. For great tasting homemade dressings, you do have to do a little hunting and gathering. But once it's done, it's over. So get some good-tasting olive oil and vinegars with great flavor. In the vinegar realm, you could choose from wine or cider vinegars, balsamic, Spanish sherry vinegar, or Japanese rice vinegar. I like rice vinegar because it's gentle and I need less oil with it. Also, it's great mixed with balsamic vinegar in a dressing. In the flavoring department, think organic fresh herbs, but if you can't get your hands on them, dried herbs will do just fine. Of course, there's garlic and onion. They're essential. And then there's cheeses, spices, chilies, sun-dried tomatoes, olives, capers. You can have a field day with all the possibilities. But let's start at the beginning. Here's the basic dressing. Now, you have to make this by taste, not by measurements. Take a screw-top jar, a pint one should work fine. Fill it a quarter full with good-tasting vinegar. Now add the same amount of olive oil. Shake it up and taste it. See if it needs more oil or more vinegar. Then you could add salt and pepper. Okay, let's say you want to dress a salad. This simple oil and vinegar dressing with the salt and pepper is the true classic Italian or French dressing. The French call it vinaigrette, and you can use it just as it is. But if you love a particular herb, sprinkle it over the salad as you toss it with the dressing. Turn the basic dressing into a Dijon dressing by putting some of it in a bowl, stir in some Dijon mustard, some tarragon, and some minced garlic or shallot. Keep tasting and keep mixing, and that way you'll know when you hit it the way you want it. How about a honey mustard dressing? Take that Dijon dressing, stir in more mustard, and some honey or brown sugar to taste. Some people also add a little bit of mayonnaise to that. Blue cheese dressing. There is nothing better, as far as I'm concerned. What you do here is you take the basic dressing, you add a little blue cheese, a hint of garlic, and that's it. If you like the creamy style, do what I just said, but then stir in a bit of mayo and sour cream. Now, ranch dressing is a great favorite. You can mix it right in the salad bowl. Just stir together equal parts of your basic dressing, some buttermilk, and mayo. Then add minced fresh scallions, some fresh basil, and parsley. Garlic is great in ranch dressing, but add it gradually to keep it from overpowering everything else. Now, here's something to think about. Once you've got your dressings, you should know that each one of them makes a dynamite marinade. For instance, try marinating shrimp in that ranch dressing. and then grill them. How about beef in honey mustard? Do it with kebabs. Keep them rare, but grill them until they're crusty. The Dijon dressing is going to be wonderful with something like chicken breasts. There, just put them in the dressing overnight, and then put them in a sauté pan or roast them in the oven. And then that basic oil and vinegar dressing, use that to marinate vegetables that you're going to roast or you're going to grill. So try making your own salad dressings this week and try turning them into marinades. And join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic French white line. Corningware can go from the freezer to the oven to the dinner table. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, our guest today claims he was born with a plastic spoon in his mouth. You would say, who cares, except he's a restaurant critic in a city where dining out can mean maxing out your credit card. Dan Leone writes the Cheap Eats column in the San Francisco Bay Guardian newspaper, and he's done a guidebook as well. His criteria? Where can you eat good food for $10 or less? And that includes the spoon, the fork, and the napkin. Dory Greenspan is our equipment expert, a savvy food writer who loves to check out kitchen gear, always with a practical, real-world slant. Today she wants to talk about the juicer, which surprised me because it's not the world's most popular tool, but according to Dory, it's made the career of some of our top chefs. She's become a juicer convert. Reporter Scott Haas is back from Italy and an impressive food event. He has a report on the Slow Food Movement's annual tasting meeting. Think tens of thousands of people attending hundreds of seminars, tasting all kinds of artisan foods from around the world. And there's a political agenda here. Appetite joins forces with radicalism. We're taking a look at a new kind of athlete, the competitive eater. And then, as we do every week, we'll be opening the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with our favorite road food duo, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Do you know what a blooming onion is?
No. What are you talking about?
It's an onion that has been smushed.
This is technical talk here.
Oh, Michael, how do you explain a blooming onion?
Well, it's kind of smushed and deep fried is what I would say.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Cut in such a way that when it's battered and hits the oil, it opens up into something that looks like a chrysanthemum.
It's kind of bar food.
Oh, I know what you mean.
You have it with drinks.
And it's wildly popular. And on our late night TV, you know, as seen on TV, they have a blooming onion maker that I'm dying to get. And, of course, will sit in the bottom drawer of my kitchen for the rest of its life. But this brings us around to just philosophically talking about onion rings in general, which Michael and I contend are something best eaten in restaurants and not made at home. It is sort of a do not try this at home. And there, onion rings kind of fall into three categories. There's onion bricks, which are...
Or loaves,
which are like lots of deep fried squiggly pieces of onion that
are
like...
Again with the technical terms, Jane.
Well, I'm very technical. Like squished into like a brick shape. Mm-hmm. Or the big rings, either the skinny ones or like the kind of extra thick ones.
Right.
Or... just plain, like French fried ones that are not even rings, that are just sort of look like French fries, but are in fact fried onions.
Well, all right, let's be specific. The ultimate giant onion hoop. We discovered in, of all places, Palm Springs, California, in a very swank steakhouse called LG's. And by the way, the steak there is unbelievably good. It's like real prime-age steak. But on the side, you get something that they call wagon wheels, which are thick-cut hoops of onion. I mean, they're bracelet size.
Bangle bracelets.
Big bracelets. Fried in a very crusty herb batter. You get maybe six or seven on a plate, and it's a huge serving. And they're served with a pitcher of ranch dressing as a condiment, which I think is superfluous, because the onion rings themselves are sweet, chewy, delicious. They're really like almost a whole course unto themselves.
What about the loaf style?
Oh, the loaf. Okay, there is one place and only one place to eat the loaf. It's a restaurant called Hackney's in suburban Chicago. Actually, there are three or four, maybe five or six branches of Hackney's. They
all around Chicago.
It is a loaf. I mean, it's the size of a Pullman loaf of bread, and it's a tightly packed bunch of, as Jane calls them, squiggles of onion that you just pick at throughout the entire meal. It gets better and better the more you pick, and finally the plate is clean, and you say, I cannot believe I ate all of that onion loaf.
That is personally my favorite kind of onion ring, is the brick, the little squiggly brick.
Okay, but now this last kind, which I'm not terribly familiar with.
Well, the last kind, Jane was not exactly correct in her description. It's not like they're, how can I put it? They're not like sticks the way a French fry is, but they're kind of small individual rings that you might be able to put on a large fat finger, let's say.
Okay. All right.
As opposed to the wagon wheel shape. I like all of these, but what I don't like are the big wagon wheel onion rings where you take a bite and the onion comes out.
Oh, that's a horrible moment.
And leaves you with just that sleeve of batter.
That
is the slithery onion.
Oh. The slithering onion. At LG's in Palm Springs, the onion stays in the batter. So that's a very nice thing. At Charlie's Steakhouse in Greenville, South Carolina, you get a smaller ring, but it's not a squiggly brick.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of between the two.
Right.
Oh, what's nice about Charlie's is that you get a half and half plate. You get onion rings on one side of the plate and good French fries on the other. So you can kind of go back and forth. It's always a tough decision as to whether to get French fries or onion rings. At least for me it is. Because I never know which is going to be better. But at Charlie's you don't have to decide. You can get half and half.
This is tough research, guys.
It's very tough research, but I'm telling you, this is very healthy. I went to the beauty parlor last week, and somebody remarked as I was getting a facial that I had fewer wrinkles than I should for my age. And I'm absolutely convinced it's from eating so many French fries and onion rings that I have this kind of, you know, extra pool of oil somewhere in my body that is sort of plumping out my skin.
So what you are advocating, in fact, is that America...
Eat grease.
Yes.
Eat grease.
Onion ring diet. You heard it here first on the Splendid Table, everyone. It is the Stearns.
I think this is my new avocation, is beauty consultant.
Thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Healthy eating to you, Lynn.
Believe it or not, that musical piece is called Onion Rings. Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their road food finds anytime, day or night, on our website. That's splendidtable.org. Dory Greenspan writes award-winning cookbooks and works with some of the world's most highly regarded chefs. She also has a penchant for checking out kitchen equipment. Her Tools of the Trade column appears each month in Bon Appetit magazine, and she comes by the Splendid Table regularly to share her latest finds. Hey, Dory, welcome back.
Hi there.
Dory, I've got a big question.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have to own a juicer?
I'm laughing because I had that question for only 14 years before I could decide.
Okay.
The first time I saw a juicer was when I was working with Jean-Georges Van Gerichten in 1986. He had this monster juicer. He had just come to New York, and he bought this juicer, and he was juicing everything from arugula to zucchini, and I was absolutely fascinated. But I, who, you know, I buy gadgets the way sugarholics buy donuts.
Yeah.
I didn't buy. Then there was the health craze, the juice craze. I didn't buy. My corner health food market was busy making juices out of, you know, their entire produce stand. And then one day, about a year ago, Jean-Georges mentioned to me that he was making this red pepper sauce. He was juicing red pepper, cooking the pepper down to a syrup, and then just putting a little bit of sherry vinegar and some olive oil in it. And he was using it over fish and over chicken and over vegetables. Don't ask why, but that alone sent me to the store, and I paid $200 for a juicer. 14 years later, I have a juicer, and I use it all the time.
What did you get?
Well, I got the juicer that Jean-Georges has, which is a champion juicer, and it's a very unusual juicer. There are two kinds of juicers on the market, the centrifugal juicer and the masticating juicer. I know.
Sounds like people I dated a long time ago.
So the centrifugal one, you know, kind of sends everything spinning around, and the masticating one chews it up. And with the most of the juicers on the market are centrifugal juicers. So you put the food in, it hits these chopping blades, and it spins around furiously. It's a little like a food processor in that sense. And then the juice gets flown through a filter and out through a spout. And that's true of all the centrifugal juicers. And then what happens to the pulp, because we're not talking about, this isn't a citrus juicer. We're not squeezing the juice.
Right.
We're really chopping it up and getting all of the juice out of it. And we're left with whatever is not juicy in the fruit or the vegetable. So all of that comes out one of two ways. Either it's collected in the juicer itself, uh-huh. and you have to empty it out after about a quart or two of juice. It's not hard. It's an extra little job, but it's not hard to do. Or it gets flung out into an external collection container. And both internal and external collection, they really work just fine. But if you're looking at a centrifugal juicer, you want to see, is it hard to clean up? Because you're not going to use it if it's really tough to clean. And also, to do the job, it's got to have a heavy-duty motor. And you want to see that motor doesn't vibrate and that the machine doesn't creep along your counter. So those are the two things to really, really look at. And there are a lot of centrifugal juicers out there. There's a Juiceman and Juice Lady, the Acme Juicerator. I love that name. I keep thinking Bugs Bunny is going to be using it. Omega makes a juicer. Miracle makes a really nice juicer. But I decided that wasn't what I wanted. I wanted the masticating juicer, maybe just so I could say the word masticating. But that's the champion juicer, and it's completely different from all the others. It's also the ugliest machine you're ever going to see. It's huge. It looks like a tank with a sausage maker attached to it. But it's an extraordinary machine. You put the chopped up food, the cut up food, into the top of the juicer, and you push it down the way you would push down meat or through a meat grinder with a little wooden pusher that comes with the machine. And the food falls against a rotating cylinder that has lethally sharp spiral cutting blades. And then the juice is filtered through a screen and released. The pulp comes out, that sausage spout. And it is so easy to clean. And it will juice anything from whole lemons. I've made great lemonade this summer. I made lemonade all the time with it. To greens. And best of all, if you close off the little screen, you can put frozen fruit in the machine and get sorbet. You can, instead of getting apple juice when you put an apple in, if you close the screen, you get applesauce. And you can put nuts in it and get nut butter.
So you get all the fiber, all the flavor.
Yeah, I think of it actually as a one-stop snack bar, because after you've made peanut butter and it's sticking to the roof of your mouth, you can make apple juice to wash it down.
Now, what is this going to set me back again?
This, not only is it not cheap, it's going to take up a bunch of your counter space too. About $200. But, you know, as I said, I resisted for 14 years. So if you amortize $200 over 14 years, not so bad.
I'm going to broach it that way to my husband. Dory, thanks.
Thank you.
Dory Greenspan is co-author of Danielle Blue's Cafe Blue Cookbook. You can get Dory's juicer picks on our website. That's splendidtable.org. Coming up, cheap eats in San Francisco, slow food in Italy, and your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Fagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. San Francisco is a prime restaurant town. Great food, but bring money. In fact, bring lots of it, because eating out in San Francisco can be pretty pricey. Enter Dan Leone. He claims to have been born with a plastic spoon in his mouth. This guy is a restaurant critic with a difference. He writes the Cheap Eats column for the San Francisco Bay Guardian newspaper and is the author of a new guidebook, Eat This, San Francisco. Dan, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn.
Dan, we hear a lot of things about great food in San Francisco, but this is not a town that has cheap food. So how do you go about finding cheap eats?
Well, the fact is that it is a town with cheap food. I think that's a misconception that a lot of people have because it's more known for its fancy pants places. But the fact is I've been reviewing restaurants here for 8 or 9 years and strictly doing cheap eats, and I haven't even scratched the surface of what's out there.
Scraped
so it's here.
Scrape seems more like it in some ways.
That's right.
How cheap, though, are your cheap eats?
Well, I like to spend $5 or something like that, and I sometimes go between 5 and 10 and sometimes go over 10. But if it's over $10, it better be something special to me, which is, you know, not saying much, I know, to most people. But I'm a starving artist, so to speak, and I represent a whole community of people in San Francisco who can't really afford to go to the fancy places.
So when you walk into a new place, what are the telltale signs that you look for?
Well, you want to see... You want to see formica, paper napkins, that sort of thing. A place that has a little character. I don't care. I don't put as much of a premium on cleanliness as a lot of other people do. But I'm in favor of paper napkins and toothpicks sitting there at the door and something that doesn't look like I'm going to have to spend an arm and a leg there.
So tell me, what are some of the latest finds?
Well, the latest find I've had that I'm most excited about is fried chicken soup. And I never knew that such a thing could occur. It seems like a contradiction in you know,
it sure
texture,
does. Sure does.
Else. But a friend of mine told me about a Japanese restaurant in Berkeley, actually, called Musashi, that specializes in, she loves the fried chicken there, which they call karage, I think. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Uh-huh.
But I went there and I saw that they also served the karage in soup. And I thought, this I have to have.
Does the fried part kind of get gummy? And
No, it's a Japanese noodle soup. There's a ton of noodles in there. And then there's these chunks of chicken battered and fried and laying on top of it, and you can eat them off the top if you don't want them to get too soggy. But I actually found that I liked them soggy. I was dipping them in the broth, and they were. I think they start out extra crispy, and you kind of want them to get a little soft. I don't understand. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's good.
It's great. I loved it. I mean, that's one of the places I've been back to a couple times.
Uh-huh. For those of us who are visitors to San Francisco, is there a particular neighborhood where we're going to find great cheap eats? Or, do you have favorite places?
Yeah, definitely. There's a couple neighborhoods I recommend going to that might be off the beaten track. The Mission, where I've lived for 10 years, is a great place for cheap eats still, even though it is becoming gentrified in parts. But you got to go to the Mission and have a burrito. I mean, that's one thing that San Francisco isn't necessarily as known for as for the seafood and different kinds of Asian food. But the Mexican food here is excellent, and that's what us real hardcore cheap eaters survive on, is a burrito. And it's a whole meal's worth of meat, rice, and beans and salsa wrapped up in this tortilla for, you know, $3. And that's with chips and salsa, and that's what people here, my friends, kind of live on.
So there's the Mission District. Any other neighborhoods?
Yeah, there's also Japantown is a good place to go for sushi and soup and stuff that's reasonably priced. Another great place, which I've been to recently, is Clement Street out in the Richmond District. If you're coming from downtown, you're going to go through Japantown and then through the Richmond to get to the Cliff House or the beach or wherever you're going out there to look at the water. And Clement Street is just packed, I mean, literally lined with restaurant after restaurant, many of which are cheap, like in the $5 to $10 range, like a great Vietnamese place called Mai's, and then as you go out further, there's a great burger joint called Bill's. These are places, you know, that have a more of a local feel to them than what you're likely to, you know, what you're likely to find down on the wharf or downtown or wherever you're hanging out if you're visiting San Francisco.
Well, this is great. Okay, so the Mission District, Clement Street. And Japantown in the Richmond.
Japantown. If you like soul food, get down to Bayview, Hunter's Point. My favorite restaurant in the city is a fried chicken and seafood shack out across from Cow Palace called Gravy's. And it's just like two or three tables. Mostly they do takeout. But this guy is actually transplanted here from New Orleans. He makes gumbo and fried chicken and poor boys and fried oysters that are just out of this world. Everything cooked to order and everything cheap for what you get. Huh. So,
this sounds good. This sounds really good. Hey, Dan, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
Dan Leone is author of Eat This San Francisco. He reviews restaurants for the San Francisco Bay Guardian newspaper. You can get his cheap eats advice on our website, splendidtable.org. What might be the most impressive food event in the Western world takes place each year in Italy. It's put together by the Slow Food Organization, and it's called Salone del Gusto, or as Slow Food describes it in English, School of Taste. This is tens of thousands of people attending hundreds of seminars, tasting all kinds of artisan foods from around the world. And there's a political agenda here as well. Scott Haas has a report from the Piedmont region of northern Italy.
This is Scott Haas, and I'm at Salone del Gusto, a celebration of food put on by Slow Food. We're in Torino, Italy, and I'm surrounded by thousands of people from all over the world looking at hundreds of artisanal producers of meat, cheeses, wines, oils, and grains. It's not just about food. It's about food as tradition, food as history, food as culture, and food, at least as Slow Food looks at it, as politics. And I'm here to meet with Patrick Martins, the head of Slow Food USA. Patrick, great to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Patrick, where are we exactly? Describe where we are right now.
Right now, we are in the Presidium Room of the Salone del Gusto, and they are exactly 100 stands, each one of which displays and provides tasting of endangered foods that Slow Food has taken it upon itself to save.
When you say endangered foods, I, of course, think about endangered animals, but is there a comparison, or is there, what's that about?
Well, whereas an endangered animal you don't want to eat.
Right.
You want to try to save. These foods, on the other hand, are foods that will be saved through consumption.
Patrick, can you show me some of the endangered products here?
Sure. For instance, right now we're standing in front of the Capone di Morozzo table. The capone is a type of chicken, and historically it can you can kind of find its equal in the States as the Thanksgiving turkey. And basically, they stopped making the capone. They stopped growing it because it didn't fatten up very fast. It's also a very temperamental type of chicken. And it also takes, so it takes a really long time. It's very difficult. It doesn't eat when it's supposed to. It was basically being, it was at risk of being lost forever.
So how does it, how is it protected?
Slow Food convinced over 10 producers to start raising the capone again.
How did they convince them?
Well, because we pre-sold the capone to over 10,000 of our members around
great.
Italy.
Oh, that's
and
great.
So through those pre-sales, they had the economic incentive to do it, and now it's hopefully going to be reestablished as a tradition.
In other words, the growers are growing knowing that the product's already sold.
Exactly.
So, Patrick, show me around the Presidio. What is there to eat here? It looks like there's a lot of great food.
Well, you have a little bit of everything. We have different types of olive oils. We have pistachio nuts. We have a race of species of cow from Piedmont called the Razza Piemontese.
What are we standing in front of right here?
Something pickled, which I'm not quite too sure
it
what
it is. It looks like pickled cheese.
It looks like it. Should we ask them in Italian?
Sure. Perché no? Let's do it.
Scusa. Perché è quasi estinto?
La mazzolina è un formaggio di capra che viene fatto soltanto nel periodo di marzo e viene poi stagionata nell'olio d'oliva, quindi si trova tra i presidi praticamente sta.
So basically this is a goat cheese that requires such a long aging process that most cheesemakers are not able to afford to wait that long before they get their economic return by selling it. And so this was a cheese that was pretty much on the verge of being lost forever, and Slow Food said we'll make it one of the 100 presidia.
So again, going back to something that's been on my mind, let's say I'm a maker of peanut brittle in Sherburn, Vermont. And I've been making this peanut brittle for some time. My kids have decided they want to leave. They want to go to school. They don't want to be any part of my peanut brittle factory. So I write to Slow Food. And is Slow Food going to keep me in business for another 3 years?
So, well, Slow Food definitely has the potential to do that. On the first level, on a local level, we would use your peanut brittle in some of our chapter events.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we would include some of your foods on our national office events. We would write about you in our various publications, the Slow Journal and the newsletter.
But you have to like it. In other words, if you guys taste my peanut brittle and you say, gee, you know, there's a reason why you're going out of business. It's got nothing to do with the economy. This stuff's no good.
It's not so much a question of whether we as the taste gods decide whether something's good or not. Does that product have a connection to the history, a connection of place and time? And if it does, that usually means that it tastes pretty good anyway.
Well, Patrick's taking us over to the American Ark area. And I expect to see hamburgers and hot dogs because I've been in Italy for about a week now. I'm feeling like that's what I'd like right now.
Well, one of the first products we're looking at is a Native American hand-harvested wild rice. It's not actually a rice. It's a grain, an aquatic grain that's produced by American Indians in Minnesota.
Wow, that's pretty long grain rice. That's beautiful, huh?
It's very good, very delicious, and it's only produced by a couple of American Indians who still go out in the wood canoe and beat these aquatic grasses in their canoe, and the rice falls into the canoe, and they sell it.
And here I see there's a poster for bison, America's original red meat.
Exactly. You can't get any more American than bison.
You know what's fascinating is that what you're really doing is you're doing a culinary history of the United States?
The ARC is the first part of the process. It's a documenting part of the process where we determine which foods we want to save, where we learn about the history of these foods. Phase two of the ARC is the Presidia, which is actually concrete economic interventions to save each of these products, to either convince our members to purchase certain foods. Sometimes we buy pieces of land and give it as a gift to the producers so that they can keep doing that.
Where do you get the money to buy the land?
Members. You know, 60,000 members. 60,000 members in the world. You have to remember also that we have over 30,000 members in Italy. So, you know, that's a huge economic weapon in a way to save these products.
We're in Italy. It's a movement that's based in Italy. What's uniquely Italian about this movement?
Well, I mean, whereas in France they have wars about their languages, in England they have wars about politics, the Italians only get totally passionate and warlike about food, protecting their food traditions. And you can't get any more passionate than the Italians for food, and that's, I think, why this movement was started here.
So it's a very political model you're describing, you know, different organizations, different chapters, different relationships with the media, and then political action following from that.
Exactly. Well, the political action comes through celebrating the good. I mean, we try to stay away from politics. You know, we don't believe in protesting on the steps of town hall. We believe in having town hall come together at the dinner table, eat great food, and protect the biodiversity in the world and in the states. Raw milk, cheeses, great beers, great vegetables.
So you're basically an optimistic person.
Exactly. I'm an optimistic person. They made me optimistic. Once you taste the food that I've eaten in the past 2 years, it's worth it.
Well, Patrick, it was really a pleasure. I hope to see you in the States. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Reporter Scott Haas maintains a base camp in Boston, but he'll travel anywhere to eat well. You can find information on the Slow Food Organization on our website at splendidtable.org. There are chapters right here in the United States. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We have Candace on the line. Hi, Candace. What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about cannelle. And they're...
Say that again?
Cannelle.
Oh.
C-A-N-N-E-L-E. And they're a specialty of the Bordeaux region from France, and they're like little mini bundt cakes in a way.
Oh, okay.
And they're made with lots of butter, sugar, eggs, milk, flour, a little bit of rum, and a little bit of vanilla.
Uh-huh.
And they have to be made in these special little molds that are about 2 inches high and 2 inches in diameter. And they're kind of sort of star-shaped in a way. Anyway, I had a recipe from a friend who was from Bordeaux. She gave me the special molds, and I tried baking them. And they tasted great, but the shape was... wrong.
The shape was wrong.
The shape
okay.
was wrong. And I searched everywhere for a recipe, and the only recipe I could find in any book was from the La Brea Bakery in L.A. And I followed that recipe, and they still didn't come out right. And what's happening is they bake beyond the edge of the mold, and you're supposed to fill up the mold all the way.
And you're saying they're overflowing the mold.
They're overflowing. So we tried two-thirds of the way, three-fourths of the way, half
right.
of the way.
Right.
And even now, if they don't go beyond the mold, they kind of shrink up so that they're not getting the full length of the mold.
Is this a yeast dough by any chance?
No.
It's just a normal leavened cake batter, essentially.
Yeah, and then there's 5 egg yolks and 1 entire egg. And a chef had told me maybe you're whisking the eggs too much. And that creates too much air in the batter, so when you bake them, they're over. But I've tried not to whisk them a lot.
But it also sounds as though it's a matter of finding how much to put in that mold, as opposed
yes.
to too little or too much, something in between.
Yes.
Because if they taste the way they're supposed to taste,
yeah.
the texture of the cake is exactly as it is in France?
Yes.
Then you're it sounds, I mean, the old recipe tester in me says it sounds right.
The fact that I'm using not a very good electric oven have anything to do with it?
It could. Do you have an oven thermometer in the oven?
I don't.
You don't. Okay. Get yourself, they're made by Taylor. They're an oven thermometer that actually has a glass tube in it of mercury. Obviously, you treat it carefully.
Yes.
But it gives you the most accurate reading of your oven temperature and see how that works for you.
Okay.
But it sounds more like either fill it a little less or fill it a little more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I bring them to people at work and everyone loves them, but I'm totally embarrassed because they don't look like they're supposed to and they're so perfect in their shape.
Yes, but you know what, Candace? The beautiful thing about something that nobody else knows about is they don't know how it's supposed to look.
They tell me to shut up, and they're good. Just shut up and stop talking about it. No one will know the difference.
You know
exactly what you just said.
There's that old dinner party theory. No matter what goes wrong, just pretend you always meant it to be that way.
Okay. I'll have to do that.
I wish I could help you more, though.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, good luck. Thanks. Candace.
Bye.
Bye. Well, it's time for our trivia question of the week. It's about egg anatomy. You know when you break an egg, you've got the yellow yolk and you've got the white, and then there's this curly white knobby thing right next to the white? Well, what is that thing, and what do you do with it? We'll be back in a moment with the answer. We'll talk with a professional competitive eater, and we'll take more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We've got open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252, and we'll talk. But before we get back to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. Now, the question was about egg anatomy. Think about breaking an egg. You get the yolk surrounded by the white. And then there's this curly white knobby thing right next to the yolk. Well, the question is, what is that? And what do you do with it? Well, it's called the chalazae. And there's two of them in each egg. They're the bungee cords of protein that connect the membrane around the yolk to the inside of the shell. When we crack the eggs, the cords snap up into tight little wads. Hence the curly appearance. The bigger the chalazae, the fresher the egg. Now, don't remove the chalazae. It's just more protein, so cook it along with the rest of the egg. The mechanics of how a chicken makes an egg are pretty remarkable. It takes a chicken 24 to 26 hours to create a single egg. Then she takes a breather for just about 30 minutes and starts all over again. And she does this for her entire life. Now, rookie hens lay little eggs, and as they mature, the eggs get bigger. And they always cackle as they lay an egg. Okay, let's get back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up. We've got Diana on the line. So, Diana, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I have a question about balsamic vinegar.
Oh.
And it's this. I have used balsamic vinegar for a long time and really enjoy it on a lot of different things. But for this Christmas, I got the real thing.
You got the Artisan Tradizionale?
Yes.
Oh, boy. Yep.
And so I know, you know, that it's very expensive. So I have this small bottle of probably, a cup and a half of this magical vinegar, and I want to use it judiciously. And I thought, well, there probably are things that I should do with it in small doses, but I wasn't sure what they were or how to find out.
Well, for everybody who's listening who doesn't know what we're talking about, there are two types of balsamic vinegar. What most of us can afford and buy is the commercial. And then there is the real traditional vinegar, and the term for it is tradizionale. On the label, you see these words, aceto balsamico tradizionale, either di Modena, meaning of Modena, or di Reggio Emilia. And those are the only two places in Italy where it's made. And this is more like a nectar or a condiment. So you don't dress salads with it. And here's the key. You use it literally by the quarter or eighth teaspoonful, and you never cook it because it's such a delicious thing on its own. You don't want to expose it to heat. So you use it on cooked dishes, and you can do almost anything with it. One great thing is drizzle it over vanilla ice cream.
On ice cream?
On vanilla, good, creamy, delicious vanilla ice cream. You will think you've died and gone to heaven. And the other thing is any grilled or poached fish is going to be delicious with it. So if you think along those lines, but just think of it as something that's a finishing touch or a sauce.
Oh, so it's almost like a salt or a pepper.
Well, exactly. And you use it in small quantities because it's so intense.
And when you put it on ice cream, in other words, if you have, you know, a scoop or two of ice cream, you're talking about a half of a teaspoon?
Well, when I do it on ice cream, I have to confess I use a bit more. But you can get away with that little.
Okay.
Yeah. I've made one of those bottles last a year, believe it or not.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So that and fish. What about chicken?
Wonderful on chicken. But put it on simple dishes because you don't want it to be fighting with other things. So a simple roasted chicken. Toss pasta with a little bit of garlic and butter or olive oil, salt and pepper, and then just sprinkle some of this on it and toss. Unbelievable. Do you see what I'm saying, though? Real simple stuff. And it's delicious. It just takes it beyond.
Okay, that sounds wonderful.
Great gift. Hey, enjoy it.
Thanks.
Take care.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. I have to tell you, that is the kind of gift that really, really says somebody loves somebody. These bottles run about $150 to $200 some odd dollars. It's just about 3.5 ounces. But the stuff is a nectar. It's really extraordinary. Well, now I've got a Splendid Table Goose Egg Award for all the chefs in Paris and the copycats in New York City who have decided that the chic new ingredient to use in dishes is, are you ready, folks, tobacco. There is actually a dessert chef in New York who is cutting up Cuban cigars and infusing a caramel syrup with them. There were two articles in the New York Times on the same day. One was talking about the trend, and the other one was talking about the medical reaction to the trend. The head of the Yale Medical School didn't hold back. He essentially thought it was stupid. Also, supposedly, tobacco in food can make some of us pretty sick. So, all those chefs out there who think this is just the neatest thing to be doing, think again, guys. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and we are eager to talk to you. We have Lara on the line. So, Lara, what's up?
Hi.
Hi. What's up, Lara?
We're going to be giving a fondue party, and I have an entertaining book, and I've looked in there to see what exactly is the how you're supposed to give a fondue party, and I can't find anything anywhere.
I think
you knew.
Yeah. Well. Now, first of all, have you decided what kind of fondue? Are you going to do cheese fondue, a chocolate fondue, or are you going to do the kind of fondue where you have hot oil and you fry things in it?
Well, we're going to do two. We're going to do a Dutch fondue for that's not
a Dutch.
Not
wait a
minute. Dessert.
Wait a minute. A Dutch. What do you mean Dutch?
It's let me look it up here. It's onions, milk, Gouda cheese, caraway seeds, cornstarch, and gin, and then you dip mushrooms and rye bread in it.
How interesting. I've never run across it. It sounds intriguing.
Yeah, it looks delicious.
Oh, that sounds great. Okay, so that's sort of your main dish, and then...
And then we're going to do some camembert for dessert.
Oh, that sounds... Well, that's kind of cheese on cheese.
Yeah.
You know,
but the other one, the second one has blueberries in it, so we figured it'd be sweeter.
Blueberries and camembert?
Yeah.
Can I just dissuade you on that one?
Okay.
No, let me explain why. Camembert on its own is a really great cheese.
Right.
Melting it and mixing it with blueberries somehow seems to be sort of a sin. You know, I think whoever wrote that recipe, God bless them, I hope they find another career.
Okay.
Yeah. No, but what you can do for dessert is a chocolate fondue.
Oh,
You know, and you melt the chocolate in a pot, you put it over just a little warmer, and then you have fresh fruit and even cut up pound cake or something like that that you dip into it. It's great. And it's easier than this, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So now you have your recipes, and what you want to know is how you put it all together.
Right. And, you know, I know I've heard of fondue parties, but and everybody said when we got our fondue pot for Christmas, you'll have to have a fondue party, but then nobody knew exactly what one was.
So. Okay, this is what it really is about. First of all, you want to have some nice white wine floating around and some red wine.
Okay? Yeah, we have both of those.
Wonderful. Okay, and then a selection of a lot of different things on the table that you can dip in that cheese fondue. And as you said, you know, rye bread, apples, maybe regular French bread, even some raw vegetables. They're not traditional, but they're really great, and they add variety to it. And the thing is, give everybody a plate, seat them in a place where they can all easily reach that fondue pot.
Okay.
You know, if it means putting it on the coffee table and everybody sits on the floor, that would be great, you know, depending on what your table is like.
Right.
And then the idea is, for a party like this, as I said, let's break with tradition. Let's have raw vegetables as well as the fruit, you know, the apples and different kinds of breads.
Right.
Then what I'd also do is I would, after the fondue, after you have the cheese fondue, and the idea is everybody sits around, you have the fondue there, you have it warm, and they just keep dipping.
Right.
Now, there's a competition at the very end of the cheese fondue where you have the cheese that sticks to the bottom of the pot.
Uh-huh.
And it's supposedly good luck if you are the person who scrapes that up and eats it.
You know, really?
Yes,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So you can say, you know, whoever gets to it first is going to have good luck for the year.
Right.
Then I would serve a little light, fresh green salad.
Oh, okay.
You know, just something to lighten and freshen your palate.
Right.
And then I'd suggest everybody takes a little walk around the block and comes back for the chocolate fondue.
Right.
And that would be it to me. I mean, I think you don't really have to do a lot. By the way, I hear in the background, how old is the little one?
21 months.
21 months?
He's banging on the bed with a Chinese musical ball.
So you're going to have the little one learn how to do fondue too?
Yes.
It is the perfect thing for a kid.
Yeah. I figure she's going to love this.
Yeah, she is.
Stabbing things and eating them is pretty much her highest idea of fun.
The adults are all going to be doing the same thing.
Right.
So does that tell you what you need to know?
Yeah, that's way more than we had.
So. Okay. Just think of that little salad in there to help refresh everybody.
Okay, wonderful.
All right, enjoy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
I'm glad fondue parties are coming back because it's really an easy way to entertain. You put one thing in the middle of the table, which you can do ahead and then just, you know, kind of warm up. And that's it. You've got a party. And forget the blueberries and the camembert. You know, there are many ways of defining an athlete. You could say anyone who competes to prove any kind of physical prowess qualifies. Kevin Lipsitz is a competitive eater. In fact, he is a champion eater, winner of several first prizes. We got Kevin on the phone. Kevin, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Now, what I want to know is, what possessed you to decide to become a competitive eater?
Well, this is just like one of my hobbies. You know, I guess some people collect stamps, other people collect coins. My particular hobbies are eating contests and caving underground. And the two hobbies usually don't coexist at the same time during the year because there's an expansion of my waistline during the eating contest. And for the caving, there needs to be a decrease in my waistline so that I can fit through the underground caverns.
How do you train?
Buffets. I know every buffet in Staten Island, New York. Well, you know, you go in, you pay your $6 or $10 for lunch or dinner, and it's all you can eat. So I go in there, I sit down, and I practice on putting as much food into my stomach in a shorter period of time. And then once I've done that, then continue to eat, and that's my workout.
I see. How many times a week do you do this?
Oh, well actually in training for the contest, usually 3 times a week, because I like to give myself a day off. So just like most people that are working out at a gym would go 3 or 4 times a week, I usually go 3 or 4 times to the buffets.
And you give it the rest in between?
Oh, sure. You need that.
Okay. Well, what's next? What's the next competition that's coming up?
Well, there's 3 contests during the year that I participate in, and these are all contests that are sanctioned by the International Federation of Competitive Eating. These are contests where they're internationally known, and they really draw a big following. So it is the Nathan's annual hot dog contest on the 4th of July in Coney Island. That's the finals, of course. In the month and a half leading up to that, they're having all kinds of regional contests all over the world for that.
I see.
But that's quite an accomplishment getting into that because the numbers keep getting higher and higher for that. Last year to get in, I had to win a regional contest by eating 15 hot dogs and buns, and the buns are actually harder than the hot dogs, in 12 minutes.
Yeah, 12 minutes.
Which doesn't sound like that much, Lynn, but it really is.
The bulk of the bun alone is tough there. But tell me, what does the winner have to eat to win? How many hot dogs?
Well, depends. You know, everybody can have an off day or on day, but I can tell you last year that the winner ate 25 and a quarter hot dogs and buns. It was a...
In 12 minutes?
That's right. That's right, 12 minutes. Actually, the Japanese came over from Japan last year, and they took the top three spots. They blew all the Americans away. They're some very, very tough eaters.
I see.
And then the third contest that I go into is the International Pickle Eating Contest, and that's sponsored jointly by Carnegie Deli and United Pickle Company in the Bronx. And that I won, so I'm the International Pickle Eating Champ.
Hey, congratulations. What's right. The prize for the pickle champion?
Well, of course, you have eaten all the pickles, so you had a nice meal of pickles. I ate 2.5 pounds of pickles in 5 minutes. Sour
That's a
pickles.
Lot of pickles, Kevin.
Yes, it is. Actually, you really can't fill yourself up in 5 minutes, but at the end of the contest, your jaw really aches because these are the crunchy pickles. So your jaw has to be in good shape for this.
I understand, but what do you get as an award? What's the prize?
Oh, is the award a pickle trophy.
Oh.
And the winner also got invited into Carnegie Deli for an all-you-can-eat meal right after the contest.
Well, Kevin, we wish you good luck on the tour.
Thank you.
And we're going to be rooting for you on July 4th. And
okay.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Kevin Lipsitz is a competitive eater who lives on Staten Island in New York City. He is the current Carnegie Deli pickle eating champion. Well, that's the show for today, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this little poem. There was a young man named Perkins who was especially fond of small gherkins. One fine day at tea, he ate 43, which pickled his internal workings. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials, nonstick, hard, anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. The Slow Food piece was produced for us by John Marston. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.